We want to make sure you know about a great way to listen to Pop Culture Happy Hour, NPR One. It's an app for your phone that works kind of like Pandora for public radio. It's full of news and podcasts, including this one. Whenever you're ready to listen, NPR One has something great just for you. Find it on your app store at NPRONE. Welcome to Pop Culture Happy Hour, our roundtable podcast about what we're watching, reading, and listening to. I'm Stephen Thompson. I'm a writer and editor with NPR Music, and I'm here in the studio with Daoud Tyler Amin. Daoud, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
That is my job. You son of... I challenge you to a duel.
There can only be one. I'll battle rap you for it.
I hear duels work out great.
Yeah, right.
So, if all the talk of duels is any indication, Daoud and I are here to talk a little bit of Hamilton. But first, if you've been following Pop Culture Happy Hour on social media, you probably know that the whole gang saw the Broadway musical Hamilton this past weekend. We had planned and continue to plan a whole show about Hamilton, which was supposed to run this week, but our dear and intrepid host, Linda Holmes, has lost her voice. Believe me, she is miserable. So we are shuffling our schedule around a little bit, and our Hamilton omnibus, our Hamiltomnibus, is going to run next week. So this week...
Meanwhile, Madison is grappling with the fact that not every... Sorry, I could do that all day.
I was going to let you. That's our show this week. Right. Tyler Amin will perform the entire cast album of Hamilton.
Just do every single part.
You probably could.
I probably could at this point. When I realized that I could do my shot off book, I was like, something's got to happen. I probably should detox a little bit. Spend a week away.
Take a little time away.
Yeah.
Well, one of the many reasons... Daoud, that I've asked you into the studio, besides my enjoyment of your company, is that you, late last year, did an interview with Leslie Odom Jr., who plays Aaron Burr in Hamilton.
That's right. And, you know, Lin-Manuel Miranda, who is the titular star and the sort of auteur of the show, I think gets a lot of the shine. One of the reasons I wanted to talk to Leslie Odom Jr. in particular is because Aaron Burr is such a weird role.
Yeah.
He is the foil to Hamilton. He is the ostensible villain, I guess, because he's the guy who will kill him by the end of the story. And we know that.
History spoiler.
That's
200-year-old spoiler.
But he's also the narrator. If you saw the Grammy performance where they casted the opening number from the show, you see him. He is the person who speaks the first lines of the show. And it starts with him saying in a very weary deadpan, how does a bastard, orphan, son of a whore, et cetera, go on to be a hero and a scholar? This is somebody who is so amazed and impressed by Alexander Hamilton and also so confounded and frustrated by him. He has to articulate all of that while being both the storyteller and a character in the story, somebody with emotional stakes. And what's amazing to me is that he does so much of that with just his voice. I don't cover theater, really. I cover music.
Right.
And I was so amazed by what he could do with just a microphone as both a musician and an actor.
So later on in this episode of Pop Culture Happy Hour, we're going to have a couple of other interviews about Gilmore Girls and Kanye West. But in the meantime, let's listen to Daoud Tyler Amin talk to Leslie Odom Jr.
Leslie Odom Jr. is here. Welcome, sir.
Daoud, thank you for having me. I'm so happy to be here.
Talk to me about singing for the theater, because Hamilton has reminded me that it's a really specific skill. And you're a recording artist as well. You put a solo album out, was it last year?
Yeah.
So in a song like Wait For It, or a song like The Room Where It Happens, these gigantic numbers, what is it that you found that Broadway demands of you as a singer?
I think everything about the theater is about extremes. I mean, that it's turned the volume up emotionally.
Uh-huh.
Every night that I show up at the Rogers, there's a demand for a range of expressiveness that, you know, at a cabaret show that I do is not necessarily, it's not demanded in the same way.
Do you need an audience to like you in theater?
Absolutely not. God, no.
Yeah.
You need them to either love you or hate you. Mm-hmm. Ambivalence is death in the theater. I mean, you know, I won't say the name of the show, but the worst show I've ever seen in New York, I went to see twice because it was so bad.
Really?
I hated it so much.
That you wanted to learn why it was so bad?
Well, when a friend of mine said they hadn't seen it, I was like, well, I have to take you. You're going to hate this thing so much. That, to me, is more interesting than just the thing that I walked out of the theater and was like, God, what a waste of 2 hours.
Right.
Right? So it's about polarization. You know, you're trying to stir up something in your audience.
Well, the way that that manifests in Hamilton, could I get you to sing one line, or is that a no-no?
No, sure.
So this is in the Act One finale. The Revolutionary War is over. Hamilton comes to Burr. He says, Burr, I'm working on this thing, the Federalist Papers. Burr is not having it, doesn't want anything to do with Hamilton's controversial ideas. And so Hamilton challenges him, and he says, for once in your life, take a stand with pride. I don't understand how you stand to the side.
I'll keep all my plans close to my chest. Wait for it. I'll wait here and see which way the wind will blow. I'm taking my time watching the afterbirth of a nation, watching the tension grow. Knock, knock, knock. I'm not warmed up. That was probably terrible and out of key.
No, you're fine. That moment is kind of incredible to me because all through that conversation, you've been trying to keep your cool. You've been trying to be dispassionate, speaking on beat, but not really engaging with the beat. And then it takes just the right provocation. And suddenly there is this operatic declaration. The whole timbre of your voice changes. And by the end of that phrase, you're sort of back in storyteller mode. You're not just talking about you. You're talking about the beginning of this country and all of the uncertainty that goes along with it. How does that happen? I mean, how do those decisions get made about what you're going to do with your voice in a moment like that?
Daoud, what a fantastic and complicated question. And I can answer it in a really simple way. It was of the utmost importance that I was not you during this process, that I did not ask the same questions that you ask or analyze it in the way that you analyze it. I believe that when art is done in its highest form, most of the good stuff is happening subconsciously. There are things that happen consciously for sure. And, you know, I come from a conservatory background. I come from the conservatory training.
You went to Carnegie Mellon?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it takes about a decade to let all of that stuff go and to go to get back to your belly, you know, to get back to your instincts. Because when you come out of school, and I graduated with honors, you know, I was a good student. I was a good boy. And I got A's and I, you know, did all the papers right. And that's not what you want to see as an audience member. You do not want to see somebody that's up there trying to do it right,
uh-huh.
trying to do it perfectly. And uh-huh. so I'll say about that moment, in the same way that it was my job to discover the breadcrumbs that Lynn had left along the way, I hopefully illuminated things for him that he didn't know he'd done. Mm-hmm. Hey, Lynn, did you realize that this thing is just like this thing you uh-huh. wrote? And this melody kind of repeats itself, but if I sing it a little differently, it'll, you know, you're illuminating. You are telling me things about the performance that I didn't realize. After I'd done all the research about Burr and I'd learned what Lynn had written and what they decided with the orchestrations, then my job is to not judge myself and get beyond any fear that I have or any trepidation that I have about doing something weird or are they going to like it, you know,
mm-hmm.
and just to go from my belly. The recording, I'm going off on a tangent, but the recording of the album was like that.
Yeah.
Because I could not go in there. It would not. It just wouldn't serve the material or anybody if I went in there and sang something the way that I'd planned it. What I tried to do on the day that we recorded the album, this thing that's going to be there forever, is, well, this is how I'm responding to the material today.
Yeah. Do you reach for something personal in those moments? Because Lin-Manuel Miranda is the only person in Hamilton who is singing his own words.
Yeah.
You were on Charlie Rose this summer, and one of the first things that you talked about was watching Deaf Poetry Jam.
Yeah.
As a, what, a teenager?
Yeah, I was like 17, 18.
And you talked about in that moment, the thing that was so compelling to you was that they seemed to need to communicate. You said they need you to get it. You said there's blood in the pen.
Yeah.
Do you remember the first time that you felt that way, that entertainment was something more than just being entertained?
Well, it didn't really, for a long time, I think I spent most of my childhood and my early years as a performer in student mode. And I think that's okay. I mean, it led me to where I am. I have a great foundation, a great training foundation, but it took me a long time to let the training go.
What does that mean, let the training go?
Well, because in material like this, I hope that there is a danger in what we're doing. I hope that we are on a razor's edge. You know, one of the best compliments that we got, one of our dressers, Jeannie, when her husband came, she said he spent the whole car ride home talking about how dangerous the show was. He said, there's a point where Anthony throws a chair across the stage, and he said, do you realize, like, if that guy didn't catch the chair, like, somebody could die in the audience, somebody could get hurt. And that is, you know, again, the biggest drag in the theater for me is if I go see an evening of theater and there's not one surprise, there's not one moment that takes my breath away or makes me, you know, if it plots along and everything goes the way I know that it's going to go. So it was late that I realized, you know, that I needed to let the training go. And what happened was I was out in L.A. doing a lot of TV and booking work, you know, working pretty consistently because I knew how to sort of call upon a thing and do it right. Mm-hmm. And so that could get you jobs. Mm-hmm. But I got very sad because one day I realized that other people's work was inspiring me and my own was not. I wasn't doing the kind of work that I loved to see other people do. Mm-hmm. And one of the biggest things that Lynn offered me with this show was the chance to be the artist that I've always loved. You know, kind of the thing in hip hop is you have to write your own rhymes.
Right.
Right. So in this situation, I wasn't going to have the opportunity to have written the words. So the very most that I could do was connect this thing to my instincts. I didn't know if I would succeed, but I knew that I had the opportunity to become the kind of artist that had always inspired me. Mm-hmm. And that is just somebody who is raw and honest and vulnerable and scary. You know, I mean, those are my favorite kind of artists. You know, when I go see a concert and I feel like I'm seeing something that is happening for the first and maybe the last time. They might not have any more left to do tomorrow.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it was somewhere in my 20s I realized that that's what my job was and that I needed to figure out, I really needed to figure out how to get there.
This speaks to me to the collaborative nature of theater. And it's actually an interesting counterpart to hip-hop because hip-hop in its beginnings was inherently a live medium and there was a strong group ethic to it. And now, like, you know, basically any kind of popular music, you can make it in your room, you can distribute it from your bedroom, you can do all of these things without ever having to talk to another person. And theater is really resolutely not like that. I mean, if it's just one person throwing a chair and there's nobody there to catch it, then, you know, there's nothing to it. So that it seems like that danger aspect is also based in trust, the trust that, that people working in theater have to have in one another.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, from its creation, you know, theater is the point is catharsis. Mm-hmm. The point is, you know, for us to all gather in the square together and laugh together and cry together and feel whatever spontaneous emotion erupts from us as a group, that is the point of it. The construct of our society is just that we, you know, all of us, we have to show up to work and be these good boys and good girls and we play by the rules and all this stuff. Theater is the place where I don't want to see you play by the rules. Yeah. I don't. That's what we do all day. What we come here for is to see you throw a chair at somebody. I want to see you break the dishes. That's why I come here. And so You know, in that way, it feels very close to the way I grew up in church, you know, which that church was the place. We didn't go to see theater growing up. And church, in its own way, you know, had a degree of theater to it. I mean, you know, there was a message that was prepared that was going to be spoken aloud. There's music and dance sometimes, and, you know, there's ritual. And so,
and you have to see those people again. It's not like being a touring artist where it's just like, that was a terrible show.
It's like
a
repertory company.
Look
at you. Yeah, that's a good, that's a good point. But yeah, it's true. It's the same community getting up each week and doing this thing for the, and it's the same need. It's worship. It is catharsis. It's ministry. And so when I'm doing my job right at the Rogers, it feels very close to that. It feels like, I think to get back to your other question, it feels like I am a conduit for whatever Lynn's messages were, and messages might be the wrong word, but whatever Lynn's intentions were about community and about what he has to say about, you know, whose country this belongs to, right? I'm a conduit for that message. And then I'm also there to usher these people in to their catharsis, to usher them closer to whatever they need to feel for that day. Yeah. And, you know, that's all of our jobs, but as the narrator, as the guide for the audience, you know, I take that part of my job very seriously.
Does it have an effect on you over time? Like, I've seen you say, and some of your fellow cast members say that, you know, this is a cast where the principals are almost all people of color. And being in the show feels like the first time that you have felt like a part of this early American history.
Yeah.
What does performance do in that sense, or the arts in general do, that traditional education can't impress upon you?
I think it's empathy. I think it is literally stepping in somebody else's shoes for a couple hours and walking around in them and seeing how it might have felt to be them, how it might have, you know, it's playing pretend. And then what happens is the same thing happens for the audience. They're watching people that look like them or, you know, that they connect to, and it's me, or it's Lynn, or it's David, or it's Renee. You know, they have, take your pick, Philippa. And they are able to, you know, feel what that person is feeling. And you know, and empathy is just, it's the first step in bringing two people from opposite sides of the table a little closer to each other. So it does, the show has made me a better friend, a better husband, a better, you know, artist. It started a tremendous amount of growth in me as a person. And that was another reason why I had to stay a part of it, because I could see those seeds flowering right from like the first reading that I did, you know? And so it was just, I mean, how do you walk away from that? You just, where am I gonna go?
Yeah.
I mean, this thing is making me a better me.
I mean, I know you saw an early version of the show before you were in the show.
Yeah.
And you saw the guy playing Aaron Burr.
Yeah.
Did you envy him?
I didn't, I didn't envy him. I was so carried away by this thing. It was presented with such simplicity, and they were just at music stands, you know? So it was presented in such a way that we were all kind of in it together in that black box theater, and just loving this thing together. I wasn't thinking that I would play Aaron Burr ever.
Yeah.
I knew that whoever was going to get to sing Wait For It 8 shows a week was going to be a lucky actor. I knew that.
Yeah.
You know, when he finished that song, I said, wow, that's a song. I've never quite heard a song like that on Broadway. Whoever gets to do that is going to be a lucky guy or girl.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. This is a weird thing to say, but the way that you talk about the show sometimes reminds me of the way that I hear new parents talk about their children.
Yeah.
In terms of like the wonderment of seeing the world with new eyes.
Yeah, I think that's exactly what it felt like, or it felt like falling in love. You know, it felt like that in a lot of ways too.
The two songs that we mentioned earlier, "The Room Where It Happens" and "Wait For It," which are kind of your two big solo moments, the more that I listen to those, the more that those two songs seem like allegories for performance. Maybe it's just something in your voice, the kind of mixture of awe and longing and a kind of lust for the thing that makes you feel like a whole person. And when people are sort of born performers, then that really is what it's like. It's like, you know, vitamin deficiency when you can't do it.
Yeah, that's really well said. And I mean, those two things were never lost on me in the creation of this. About the room in which this thing happened, the room that this was created in, it was the most loving, creative, gentle space that I've ever been a part of. And I think that that's one of the reasons why the show looks the way it does and feels the way it does, because nothing was wrong and you could fall flat on your face and you try again tomorrow. It's okay,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And so that, yes, I was singing the room where it happened. I mean, it was very easy for me to connect it to my actual life. And even wait for it, I remember when I, you know, we would do these readings early on. You know, there was no timeline for me. I was not aware of when Hamilton would happen off Broadway. I was not aware of when it would happen on Broadway. Uh-huh. And there's so much rejection that I felt over the, you know, over the past years, that most jobs I do not get, even if I've been a part of the development and stuff. Uh-huh. You know, most things move on. So this thing, I was falling in love with it. I loved it more and more. And I didn't know if I was going to end up being the guy. And so over the course of the last 2.5 years or so, it's very tricky, but I had to keep my schedule free,
right.
Which meant turning down work, which meant, you know, for no guarantee, you know, but I knew that I sing a song. Every time I do that show, I sing a song called Wait For It.
Right.
And I know what this opportunity could be. So I would sing that song to minister to myself. I would sing that song to, you know, it did feel like it was, you know, meant for me. You know, those messages were meant for me to hear, and now they're meant for me to deliver to somebody else who needs them.
Wow.
I'm willing to wait for it.
Said explicitly a couple of times, he's like, the company is happier when everyone has food to eat. The Room Where It Happens and Wait For It are two of the best songs I've ever written, and I don't get to sing them.
Lynn was incredibly generous with this material. And not only Lynn, you know, Blankenbuehler and Thomas Kail and, you know, our lighting designer, our costume designer, Paul Tazewell, they wanted everybody to shine. They wanted everybody, when it's your moment, you know, what do you need? Because it's not always about what you're doing when you're in your light. It's not always about clearing space so that you can do something extraordinary. Sometimes the most extraordinary thing you can do is nothing.
Uh-huh.
The most extraordinary thing you can do, the biggest political statement you can make, is to stand there at the center of the stage and be naked and do nothing. Just let us look at ourselves in your eyes. You know, we have the chance in theater. It doesn't always have to be the way it actually is, meaning we can imagine it in a more perfect way,
uh-huh.
Right? We can show what it could look like. This is the potential. This is what friendship and relationships could look like if we wanted them to.
It's the bittersweet thing about theater. I think good theater always feels kind of bittersweet, because if it's been well done, you get a sense of the work behind it, and you get a sense of the danger involved in it, but you also feel it ending one moment at a time.
Mm. It's true. I mean, but it's the thing that keeps you coming back, right? I go see the Ailey Company every single year when they're at City Center, because,
uh-huh.
I mean, nothing inspires me quite like dance. It's just such a pure physical expression. It is, you know, it's distilled even down, you know, farther from what we're doing at the Rogers. It's just pure movement.
Yeah.
And they are superheroes, because, you know, that amazing thing, that superhuman feat that I just saw, you did it. There's no wires, there's no special effects. It just happened,
yeah.
You know? So nothing inspires me like that. I go every year.
There's this theme in Hamilton about legacy. And one of the messages of the show is that you don't always have control over that. Do you think about your own legacy? I mean, do you think about, especially in theater where you have the cast album, but it's one of the quirks of theater is that there isn't really a definitive document.
I think about it a little bit. I think about it in this way. Because I am so connected to the people that got me started, you know, the people that helped me, I am very conscious of how I pass that on. I'm very conscious of how I continue the line, my place in the line. People like Michael McElroy and Billy Porter were angels in my life, really, who gave me early opportunities and gave me early advice. I wouldn't be here without words of encouragement like that, and not to mention the teachers and the stuff that I had coming up in Philadelphia and stuff. So I know that their legacies burn bright in me, you know, and I talk about them always and I thank them still. So I am very aware and conscious of my responsibility to do that for somebody else. I think that I won't fully understand what we're doing at the Rogers until I have a second away from it, you know, because, I mean, we're still in the middle of it.
Right.
But every now and again, somebody will come and they'll say something to me about the show or my performance or somebody else's performance in the show that reminds me of what somebody did for me in their performance. You know, that I see that light in their eyes that was in my eyes after I saw a Deaf Poetry Jam or in my eyes after I see Audra May perform or Bilal perform, you know, Lettucey. I mean, I've seen Lettucey do some, you know, things that I'll never forget, you know, and so that is your legacy. You know, your legacy lives in the hearts and the minds of people that see these performances. And so, yeah, I have a little bit of a sense of it now. I might have more of a sense of it after it's all done.
Leslie Odom Jr., thank you so much.
Thank you.
You know, you can tell that Leslie Odom Jr. thought you were pretty cool, Dode. I love how he was like, that is the most brilliant question I've ever heard.
Yeah, I mean, like I told you earlier today, when I was sitting and talking to him, in the back of my mind the whole time, I was just thinking, you know, you don't have to do this, right? You don't have to speak so generously when you're doing press. People will still have you do press.
Well, anyway, thank you, Dode, for being a part of Pop Culture Happy Hour.
You bet. Thanks, Stephen.
This podcast and the following message are made possible by Weebly. You don't have to be a web designer or know code to create a fantastic website with Weebly. Created for people with the courage to start their own business and the dream to be their own boss. Choose from professionally designed mobile-friendly themes. Then just drag and drop to quickly build and publish your site and update your site on any device. Get started for free at weebly.com/happyhour. weebly.com/happyhour.
Welcome to Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. I'm here in the studio at NPR in New York, and I'm here with Sean Ramos-Firm. Hi, Sean.
Hi, Linda. How are you?
I'm great. Sean is a host at WNYC. Can I ask you what you're doing, or is this all completely classified?
You
what
absolutely
are you doing
can.
These days?
It's out there. I sometimes tweet about it. I'm piloting a new show. It will not be called Pop Culture Happy Hour, but
That's
it might
good.
Be sort of about pop culture. But we could all be friends and share the pop
oh,
culture.
Oh, no. I see. You're telling me about this on air so that nothing really dangerous can happen.
I mean, I think it'll be sort of like my prior bygone podcast, Sideshow.
I was going to say, you might know Sean from Sideshow if you listen to that awesome show,
Thank
which
you
I
very
miss
much.
Very much.
Thank you very much. Thank you for listening and recommending it once
I
on
did.
Earbud. It was so meaningful to
did.
Me.
I did. I
you.
Recommended it.
Yeah.
It was a great deal of fun, but on to other great things.
Sure, but similar things. So you know, we all coexist. It's a beautiful thing. There's lots of space out there.
Absolutely. Yeah. So we have been in New York talking to a bunch of people who we asked essentially, what's on your mind pop culture-wise? What do you want to talk about? And Sean said, I want to talk about Kanye.
Don't run away, though.
And I said, I want to hear you talk about Kanye, even though, as I understand it, Sean is also public radio's resident Drake expert.
This is true.
Correct?
This is true. I don't think Drake would exist without Kanye. Kanye created an ecosystem in which Drake could flourish. And this is why, despite how easy he has made it now to really loathe Kanye West, I think we still need to give him what my aunt and uncle would call a broad margin.
Nice.
And truly consider his work and his madness and his oversharing and his reprehensible tweets alongside this amazing catalog of work that he has produced right. over the course of a decade or more. And so that is why, Linda, I right. said, let's talk about Kanye West.
Absolutely.
Not in the way he sends a tweet and the whole blogosphere reacts, but in a way that I have now spent almost a month with this album of his.
Right.
And I think it's worthy of a conversation.
Okay, so first explain to me kind of the roots of your Kanye fandom.
Sure, yeah. So he released The College Dropout when I was still in junior college in Southern California, and it was the most melodic hip-hop album I'd ever heard, and it was so soulful. And I liked hip-hop already, but I liked hip-hop for different reasons than I would say listen to very melodic music.
Sure.
I didn't go to hip-hop for that. But here I was enjoying music and hip-hop at the same time in a way I never had before. And I thought it was really compelling. And I would share it with my rocker friends who were less into rap. And they, too, would sort of get it, except when Kanye would say things that were really provocative, like, we're trying to buy back our 40 acres.
Right.
When friends would be like, I don't know about that. But I would love those moments because it was
right.
it made some of my, like, admittedly white friends uncomfortable that this guy was sort of provoking on racial lines. And then,
so, like, that discomfort is baked into the fandom from the beginning.
I think so,
like,
yeah. It was always there.
Yeah,
and then,
yeah.
of course, you know, he became a superstar for saying George W. Bush does not care about black people during a Katrina fundraiser. And that was, I feel like, as someone who had a podcast about relatively viral stuff, that was maybe one of our first cultural moments where everyone saw it and saw it again and saw it again on the internet. Whether you were watching that fundraiser live or not, which I was.
Yeah, you could, I was too.
Yeah, you could spend your time watching that video over and over again and like glorying in the shock on Mike Myers' face or feeling, I felt a deep sympathy for this guy who couldn't help but say something that he felt so strongly
mm-hmm.
in this moment. And it hurt him to say it looked like, and I think it really did. And then I was just in his corner forever. And
right.
then, if I'm ranting, tell me. But and then he released a series of incredible albums that
sure.
were practically flawless. Late Registration had this luscious production from John Bryan, who is already one of my favorite producers. Kanye West had the smarts to go after a guy who worked with Fiona Apple and Amy Mann to produce a rap record for him. And it was just the most brilliant thing I'd ever heard. And then not long after, he released My Beautiful Dark Twisted Fantasy, which is, I think, still remains like the dark side of the moon of hip hop. And then after that, people probably ask, where's this guy going to go next? He did Yeezus, which to me is like the Kid A of hip hop. And then there was this pregnant pause and people started to think, maybe this guy can't do it again. I mean,
mm-hmm.
how could we blame him for not being able to do this again, to reinvent himself completely again? It would be Bowie-esque. And that brings us to the life of Pablo.
Yeah, let's talk about the life of Pablo.
So, I mean, this is an album that he tried to gradually reveal details about on Twitter
yeah.
by himself in the most ham-fisted way imaginable.
Yeah.
It started with this sort of smart posting of a track list, which was just, you know, Sharpie on Notepad and sort of friends who had been coming by the studio signing off on it. And, well, this album went through several album names.
Yeah.
The track listing kept changing publicly. He was sharing far too many details. He proclaimed it would be the greatest album of all time.
Sure.
Never a good idea before an album release to proclaim that it'll be the greatest album of all time, especially when you're Kanye West and you've released some really remarkable albums.
Right.
And your fan base is already terrified that this one won't be that. And then, you know, there were just terrible, terrible tweets, including one saying that Bill Cosby might be innocent. And then at that point, I didn't even want to listen. I've had friends call out Kanye West on Facebook, and they said, Kanye, you need to shut up. And this was years ago before all this
yeah.
Life of Pablo stuff. And I would defend him. I would say, listen, this guy has had the biggest influence on what Kurt Anderson once called the last great invention of American culture on hip-hop than any other person in memory. And he deserves a broad margin, even when he's being sort of
sure.
annoying. But when he said that thing about Cosby, I was just like, no, I can't. My brother said to me, like, why does Kanye hurt the ones who love him? And that's actually how I felt. I said, like, I don't think I even want to hear this album. And then I heard the first song on the album, and I had to listen, and it's called Ultra Light Beams. And I brought a clip. I don't know if you want to play it.
Absolutely.
But it's really beautiful.
I laughed in my head because I bet that my ex looking back like a pillar of salt. Because they flipped the script on your ass like Wesley and Spike. Now mess with the light. Look at the channel from 79.
We on a ultralight beam. We on a ultralight beam. This is a God dream. This is a God dream. This is everything.
Hallelujah.
Everything.
I'm trying to keep my faith.
Yes.
But I'm looking for more.
having seen the track lists, Kanye was releasing songs in the lead up to the album's release. He was dropping songs on Twitter and SoundCloud and stuff. And some of them were really bad. And then in these permutations of the track listing, you saw the track listing kept growing.
Yeah.
And some of these songs that were terrible and seemingly drafts had made it onto the album. And it was so puzzling to me that this perfectionist was putting these surely like lesser songs from his catalog on this track listing. And then the New York Times, John Caramanica said, maybe unfinished is the new finished. And
That's an amazing line.
I laughed.
That's an amazing thing for a critic to say, I think.
I think so, too. And then Pitchfork's Jason Green gave the album a 9 out of 10. Rolling Stone's Rob Sheffield gave it a 4.5 stars out of 5. So after hearing that song, I listened to the album thinking, okay, I must have had it wrong. And I think all of those people should maybe be fired. Which is a really bold and stupid thing to say.
But you would not give it like a 9.
Oh, my God. This is, for sure, this is like a half-good album.
And yeah.
It's at times great. Like on Ultra Light Beams, it is great.
Yeah.
But it is at times reprehensibly bad, I think.
Just like a bad record.
And I think all these reviews are saying like something that is partially true, which is Kanye West has been perfect, not his personality, but his music has been perfect and increasingly perfect for so long. And it's been outstanding and dumbfounding, and there's no way to sustain that. And here is a new version of himself, and it's imperfect, and it's a work in progress, and it's in draft form, as well as finished, as well as unfinished. And that is a valid argument. I don't know. In my mind, criticism should be about the quality of the product and not like the larger theme.
I mean, I think people have a kind of a romantic idea of what it means to show your process,
right,
and show, like, you know, this is the looking at the backside of the tapestry, right?
Yeah. Sure. Yeah.
And what that process is like. I mean, there are all these like Rhino Records releases of Elvis Costello,
right,
early versions everything from Imperial Bedroom.
Yeah.
That really does show you what goes into writing songs.
Yeah.
But very often, I would listen to those and then I would think, I get why he went with the later version, mm-hmm, instead of that one. So it's an interesting thing, but it's different from saying, this is brilliant in that it's unfinished.
Exactly. And maybe for Kanye, that's okay. But I think Caramanica, for example, cited the Rihanna album as another example of this unfinished thing. Rihanna made us wait so long for her album, and it's just sort of okay.
Mm-hmm.
But to me, coming from Rihanna, it's not as compelling because Rihanna's never been like this perfectionist. Kanye's famously and like madly obsessed with having the best representation of his work out there. I've seen him live in Chicago at Lollapalooza, and he refused to come on until he got everything right. And the crowd was booing him by the time he came on, and he had like a mental breakdown on stage because he wanted everything to be perfect and they didn't understand. So I think with him, it is excusable, but it's also rare to have. So you get like the Dylan sessions and the Costello sessions,
right,
years later.
Right.
But we've got it all now. It's
right,
still on SoundCloud and on YouTube, so we can hear these drafts and the final product and the changes he's still making, apparently, to this album all at once. And it's such a different experience. And maybe in some way it's sort of groundbreaking.
Yeah, well, and one of the things you talked about is that he's kind of encouraging people to play around with it themselves up to a point.
I think he is subconsciously encouraging people to tweak the album
and
as they see fit by having tweeted so many different versions of his track list and by suggesting, very frankly, that he couldn't make up his mind on what this thing should be, though he thought it was the greatest album of all time before he tweaked it four more times.
Yeah.
So that's the funny thing about it. So Kanye's version of the album, I believe, is 19 songs long. I don't have Tidal. I will admit that my friend sent me a version of the album. That's mm-hmm. how I first heard it.
Mm-hmm.
And his version was even longer. It had a couple of extra tracks. And he said, oh, I subbed in this one here. I subbed in that one there. And it's become, what's brilliant about this experience of listening to this album is that there may not be a version of this album. The first version I had ever heard was my friend Joe's version.
Right.
And I couldn't stand at least four or five songs in it, so I started trimming it off, and I came up with my perfect 14-song version of it. And even in that 14-song version of it, there's a couple songs I would like. But what's interesting is the version my friend Joe sent me already had remixes and edits of the album, and you can find endless amounts of people saying, like, oh, I like that.
Wow.
I like that one with the Frank Ocean verse and not this one. And somewhat on Vice flipped one of the better songs on the album called Wave. The title of the blog post on Noisy was, "Some reverse Kanye West's waves, and it sounds like a radio broadcast from heaven."
It does sound a bit that way.
It's a little ethereal, right?
I
The song's pretty the right way, too.
But, yeah.
But I'm so fascinated by these things popping up instantly and how people are latching onto them and even replacing them as their favorite version of the song. And here's my version of the album. And I think that's an experience that Kanye, through all his madness and terrible tweets, Kris Jenner needs to take his phone away, has given us. And he said something. He did this interview in Interview Magazine once where Steve McQueen, the filmmaker, interviewed him. And this was 2 years ago, in 2014, January 2014. But he sort of presaged that he would do this. He was talking about the Bound 2 video, and he said, "It's about the creative process even more than the final product. I think there's something kind of depressing about a product being final, because the only time a product is really final is when you're in a casket."
Wow.
It goes dark, as it often does with him. But it's funny because this is a guy who was obsessed with the final product, and then now it seems that he's just about sharing things in whatever form he feels like, and I think people are reacting to that in a very interesting way that's sort of unprecedented.
It's absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you, Sean.
Thank you.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from HBO Now, the new way to stream all of HBO. Every episode of every season of HBO's series, plus the biggest and latest movies before any other streaming device. And no TV packages required. Download the HBO Now app on your favorite device to start your 30-day free trial instantly.
Welcome to Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. I'm here in the studio at NPR in New York with Daisy Rosario. Daisy is a producer for Latino USA, which is independently produced, but NPR distributes, as well as the host of the podcast Serially Obsessed, which is about being obsessed with cereal. Welcome to the show, Daisy.
Thank you so much for having me, Linda. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, we're psyched. When we asked people what was on their minds, pop culturally speaking, Daisy mentioned the upcoming Netflix return of the Gilmore Girls.
Yes.
Now, as I understand it, you were not a fan of the show when it was originally on.
No, I didn't watch it when it was originally on, although I realized kind of looking back that it was during this big window of time where I really was not watching a lot of television as it aired.
What brought this show into your life recently?
So I saw that it was on Netflix, and my boyfriend is also a longtime fan, and I had always been kind of interested in it. I was, like, curious about it. I was super aware of it when it started airing, because when I was in college, I was at NYU. I was in Tisch for acting, and my next-door neighbor roommate in my freshman dorm was Alexis Bledel, who plays Rory on the show.
She sure does.
She actually was in acting school, so I remember when she left to go do the pilot, and then when she left again to go do the show because it got picked up. And so, to me, it was the show that starred that girl that I used to live next door to for a while.
Nice.
Whose room I had to break into once to turn off an alarm clock that wouldn't stop going off in the middle of the day.
So you had, like, a personal connection.
Yeah, you know, and it was strange to me. And also, I was in college. I grew up the only child of a young single mom, so I was off having my first adventures. I was not tuning in late at night to stuff like that.
So how recently did you dive into it?
I started watching it last year, and I worked my way through the entire series, wrapping up just after the new year.
So if there's anyone who is not familiar with the Gilmore Girls is the story of a single mom who has a daughter that she had very young. So I think when it starts, Rory's like 16 and Lorelai's like
32. Yeah, she had her about 16.
Yeah.
So you're meeting them right when Rory is the age that Lorelai was when she had her. And then I was having this whole weird reaction to the show because I basically grew up like the Rory character.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. I heard you on a panel last week talking about a story that sounded very kind of related.
Yeah, my mom had me when she was a teenager, and growing up it was just her and I, and we were so close. I mean, really just thick as thieves. I definitely was that person that was like, my mom's my best friend and I was hers. And, you know, we had our own little world. And so to start watching the show, I always knew it was about a mother and daughter, and very clearly just from looking at them, obviously, Lauren Graham is supposed to have been young when she had Rory, but I didn't realize how much I would relate to it having grown up similarly. And I mean, there were so many times just starting to watch it, I was like, oh my God, I was so much like Rory. Like, my mom barely finished high school. She probably would have barely finished high school even if she didn't have me, but I was the really good kid who was clearly bright from a young age, like tested into accelerated classes and things. Like in kindergarten was always, I'm going to college, which was exactly like the dynamic with Gilmore Girls. So I knew it was about a mother-daughter. I didn't know exactly how much it would hit home for me.
And you were very close to your grandparents, too, right? You talked about that as well, that that relationship that Rory has with Lorelai's parents, you know, you were very close to your grandparents as well.
Yeah. My grandparents were kind of the real sense of stability in our lives to a degree. And I think we had a better relationship with them. My mother had a better relationship to my grandparents than Lorelai necessarily does on the show. My grandparents were not wealthy, but they had more than us. I always say, like, my mom and I were poor. My grandparents were working class. And so they were the ones who would offer to pay for things if necessary, or my mom would have to go to them for certain things and offer help here and there. And, you know, but even then, my dynamic with them was very different. My mother is very different than my grandma, and the two of them did have their issues for a while, and then I was very close to my grandfather. So, yeah, I felt like, oh, my God, I didn't know that this show is so much about my life.
Are there specific moments on the show that you can look at and say, I really relate to this specific event or moment?
Yeah, I can think of kind of two things. So one is the overall relationship between Rory and her grandfather and how much she's like him in personality, and they have the same interests that maybe everybody else in the family doesn't quite understand why they both love these things. That was absolutely my dynamic with my grandfather, and that kind of sense of pride that you can see in him and her was very special to me. Like, when I got into college, the first person I was probably the most excited to tell was my grandfather, even though I knew my whole family would be excited for me. Like, telling him that I got into the place I wanted meant more. And then there's a very specific episode in season 4 that I cried like a baby when I watched it, and I wasn't expecting to. I just lost it. It's an episode called The Incredible Sinking Lorelai's, and it's Rory's at college for the first year, and Lorelai and Rory they're just both so super busy, and they can't quite connect that week, and they're so used to being each other's support system, and they're both off doing the thing that they love and they're so excited about, but they both feel like they're failing, and they just completely lose it, half out of fear of, like, letting the other one down. And I was watching this, and I really remembered some very specific instances that were very much college-related to that same feeling. I mean, I immediately started texting people, like, guys, this episode is too much. This is one is killing me. I can't. Oh, God. Like, I was in it. I was so in it. Yeah.
And I should say, there's an episode of Latino USA that I was listening to the other day called Abuelos.
Yes.
Where you talked to your grandfather.
I did, yeah.
And he talked about a whole bunch of other stuff. And people who listen to this show should also listen to that show, because that same episode has an interview with Yvonne Cole.
Yes.
Who plays a bunch of...
She's like every Latina grandma on TV.
She
is. It's the
same
actress.
Including the wonderful one on Jane the Virgin, which is a show that we have talked about on our show.
Oh, yeah.
So I highly recommend that one. But that was a very interesting conversation with him because, you know, he's so invested in you, and it's a wonderful talk. And I think, you know, for folks who are curious about that, I would encourage them to seek that out. When you look at that show over the course of, like, that whole bunch of seasons, did you feel equally attached to it all the way through? Because I'm curious. I think a lot of people felt like, you know, like a lot of shows, they gradually kind of dropped off their interest in it.
Oh, sure.
But
yeah.
I'm curious about whether it's different when you kind of watch it later in a more condensed period of time.
Watching things, I mean, binge watching is always such a weird experience because you start to not know where the boundaries are. Like,
right.
I didn't always know when, oh, right, I've started into this season.
Right.
Or I'd fall asleep in one season and wake up in another. I did feel very connected to it all throughout, except for the 7th season,
yes.
Which is controversial. Apparently,
sure.
I caught up on the internet to see how controversial the 7th season of Gilmore Girls is for everyone. And that was the one that I didn't relate to. But I think I went through such a similar trajectory in a lot of ways. And my mom, I could see her going through the same kind of, like, who am I now that my daughter's not in the house all the time and doesn't need me every minute? Like, who am I? And that kind of growth felt very real and natural. And then the 7th season is a huge problem for many reasons. It is, like, so, like, the tone changes immediately. The writing is clearly different. Like, everything about it is different. And I was sitting there just as frustrated as probably people were as it was airing. Just,
yeah. How do you feel about it coming back? Do you have that feeling of, like, I really want to catch up with everybody? Or do you have that feeling of, like, leave it be where it is?
Oh, man. I am really excited, but that excitement is definitely tempered by my reaction to other Netflix revivals.
Such as?
The Wet Hot American Summer one is rough for me. And I say this as someone who is friends or friendly with a lot of people who are involved in it. But I mean, I was just like, man, the last thing I want to see is you explaining why a bunch of weird stuff happened when all the weird stuff was funny just because it was funny.
Sure.
I don't need to know why he's a can of peas. That's weird.
Right.
The Arrested Development, I heard there was, like, a recut version where he gets rid of the weird format that he put it in, and I think I would probably enjoy that version more. I didn't hate it so much, but,
yeah,
you know, it's been hard. And so I'm excited, but I do think that with Gilmore Girls, you do have a little bit of a different thing in that controversial seventh season. What's controversial about it is that the show creator, Amy Sherman-Palladino, had left by then, and she really was the one who really wrote the scripts. And she said in interviews that the writers would develop the plot, and then she or her husband would go over it to keep it sounding the same, and
she's such a stylist. A dialogue stylist. I think very much the same way as Aaron Sorkin.
Yeah.
She's a stylist of, like, how people talk. Did you ever watch Bunheads?
Oh, yeah.
I loved Bunheads, yeah. And that's her other, like, awesome show that's very similar in feel in some ways, yeah. I think.
Absolutely. Yeah, I hadn't seen the whole thing. I'd seen a few episodes, and then when I watched Gilmore Girls, I was like, yep, I know.
Uh-huh.
I kind of recognize this from Bunheads.
Absolutely.
And so I think there's that unfinished feeling for Gilmore Girls with the seventh season where I think where it ended, I felt okay about the ending itself, but the journey there in that final season was not nearly as much fun or as interesting as it would have been.
Yeah.
And so the fact that it's coming back with the creator, I think sounds more promising to me, as like she's going to get to do what she wanted to do in some
right.
way.
One of the things that is so weird to me about internet reactions to shows like this, and it was also true of Veronica Mars, is that you create these like really interesting young women, and then so much of the conversation becomes about like which boyfriend.
Oh God, yeah.
Which boyfriend do you root for? And they have announced over time that all three of like her main boyfriends,
yes.
Dean, Jess, and Logan,
yeah.
who I think of as the other one.
The other one, it's so true.
Yeah, are coming back in yeah. some capacity, right? I have to assume with the length of this thing, which is not that long, they can't spend a whole lot of time on all of these dudes.
I know, and I'm also, I'm really torn because I'm a very, like, not spoiler person.
Right.
But you can see that they're letting you know, like, this person is signed on for this many episodes. And I had to, like, shut it
right.
down because I was like, I can't know. But I think that is the other thing that feels weird about season seven is you're like, would this character have stuck around as long as they did? Like, would we be with Logan forever? This is
for
so
such
frustrating.
A long time.
Ugh.
And then he went over to be on The Good Wife, where he's very good, I think. But when he was on this show, he did nothing
oh
for me.
Oh, my God.
All right, so boyfriend-wise, where do you fall?
I am definitely more just straight up team Rory. I do
right.
appreciate the dynamic of each of them, though, especially having related. Like, I had a Dean. His name was Steve. He was lovely. He was really sweet.
Right.
He was my first boyfriend, and we dated a really long time.
Right.
And my mom would be like, he's a really nice guy.
Yeah.
So I've been there. But I also got to the point where watching the show where I was like, Dean, just go away already. Just go away. Like, Dean is still around. Like, ugh. Like, when will I stop seeing Dean? And then, like, I'm watching it after the fact. So I'm like Googling, like, when does Supernatural start? Is he going to show, like, leave by this season? When does he go away? And then Jess is like such a pain in the neck.
Oh,
Jess is
God.
Just a huge pain in the neck. And
so
I have
so many of that guy.
Oh my God. So many of that guy, for, right? Like, But I had some empathy for Jess in that I grew up around a lot of foster kids. So I was like, I've been around and have had the experience of my own absentee dad of like how it affects your behavior and the way you strike out in anger when you don't have
sure.
that good dynamic. But I was also like, but don't date him, Rory. Like,
exactly.
Talk to him about books.
You
like,
can feel empathy for him,
yeah.
but you don't have to make him your boyfriend.
Like, he'll give you the best comment on Steinbeck and like then nobody else will and you guys can move on. But
and he's
don't
that,
date him.
Like, he's that dude.
Yeah.
He's like that young dude. Everybody has that young dude. But
yeah.
you don't have to make him your boyfriend, especially not forever.
Not at all. And then, you know, Logan is like, Logan is as nice of a person as he could be, considering the garbage people that we clearly see in his life, but that's not enough for me to care. And that's the other hard thing about the seventh season is it feels like it really starts to, my boyfriend said, I will give him credit for this, he said the seventh season feels like they become the manic pixie dream Gilmore Girls. Like,
nice.
All of a sudden, they are saving the guys in the
right.
situation, and they're so concerned.
Uh-huh.
And it's like, that's never been the focus of this show. Get out of here with this mess.
To me, the clearest thing about Rory coming back older is I look at it and I think, why would you only pick from the people that you were dating when you were,
oh my God.
Like, 18 years old? That
exactly.
sounds like a terrible idea. For
yeah.
most people, by the time they're older, like, you wouldn't want that to be the entire selection of people to pick from.
I know. Like, what did her life become that she only has these guys if she had such a bright future ahead of
well,
her?
Well, exactly. It's like, where's the other guy?
Yeah.
Can I be on team, like, Those Are Boys Find a Man? Can I be on team, I don't know.
People were so excited about Jess, too. And it was funny because, like, as I was seeing it, like, people being excited about it and where I was in the show, I was like, meh. And then at the end, with kind of the last things that we see about Jess, I was like, this is not enough to make me team Jess. I was like, I'm glad that there are improvements in
him.
And I think that that's nice. But also now, again, being the Lorelai age, I'm like, that's great. It happens in your life that you have people that kind of like spark something in you and help you at the right time. And it's great that they could have been that for each other. You don't need to, like, end up with that person 16 years later.
Well, right. And the other thing is, specifically with a guy like Jess, either when you meet him and he's, like, 30, either he's really different, mm-hmm. in which case he's really different, and who knows if you still like him, or he's not really different, in which case, zikes.
Right. Like, otherwise, you find out it was a blip that he had. he had a good 6 months, and then he went back to being a pain in the neck.
Well, exactly. As, like, a 30-year-old version of what he was as a kid?
Yeah.
Ugh.
I know. I love the way they showed that, like, he had evolved because, like, he's in blazers in later seasons. Mm-hmm. Like, at first he was barely, like, always very brown and drab, and then it was like, he's in a blazer now, guys.
Blazer.
He really brought it together.
He's got himself together. He's wearing a blazer.
He hosts artist parties.
Absolutely. So in the end, you're going to watch it.
Oh, yeah. I'm going to watch it, and I'm going to be clutching the furniture in fear because I did love it, and it felt really hard to hit that seventh season, especially binging. I was like, oh, I'm giving myself too intense of an experience of this failure.
Absolutely.
Season 7.
All right. Well, I so much appreciate you coming in to talk to us about Gilmore Girls.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I mean, I've been talking to people's ear off about Gilmore Girls, so the bigger the audience for that, the better.
Absolutely. Full episodes of Pop Culture Happy Hour are available every Friday on iTunes or wherever you get podcasts, or at npr.org. Thank you, Daisy.
Thank you.
And that brings us to the end of Pop Culture Happy Hour. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at IDislikeSteven. You can follow Linda at NPRMonkeyC. You can follow our guest Daoud Tyler Amin at ArtSorority. You can follow our guest and pal Shyam Ramaswaram at Ramsram. That's RamesWaram. You can follow Daisy Rosario at ItsDMR. That's ITSDMR. You can follow our producer, Jessica Reedy, at Jessica_Reedy. And you can follow our producer emeritus and music director, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff. That's KATZIF. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in-and-out music, which you are tapping your foot to now. Thanks to all of you for being here. Thank you all for listening, and we will see you back here next week. Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. NPR's new Politics podcast is where NPR's political reporters talk to you the way they talk to each other, with perspective on the primaries and beyond, short takes on news, and reporting from the campaign trail. You don't have to keep up with politics to know what's happening this election year. You just have to keep up with them. Listen and subscribe to the NPR Politics podcast at npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app.